Well, good evening, and thank you very much for giving me this opportunity to give a personal perspective on the events at Fukushima and the possible implications for the United Kingdom. You've all seen this, this picture before, but this is what it was like before the event. Fairly old power station by light water reactor standards. I think Unit 1 was commissioned about 40 years ago. In 71. I picked this picture up off a document produced by METI just recently, which I think is quite illustrative of the scale of the challenge that this nuclear power plant faced on the 11th of March. And it's interesting to see that you know, the sheer scale of that tsunami, about 14 meters, completely flooded the reactor site, deluged all of the systems. And the picture in the corner showing you the impact of the wave hitting the turbine building, showing a splash up to, what, 46 meters. Sheer scale of things that we can't contemplate. But for today, what I'd like to talk to you about is give my views on the accident, how it developed, some of the key issues that I think arose from the incident. The way the UK deals with its standards for external hazards, and then some interim observations. And I can assure you that I did write these before Mike produced his report today. Just to remind you what we're actually talking about, this is a sort of first-generation boiling water reactor, quite unusual compared to the reactors that we have here in the United Kingdom. But the key issues are the pressure vessel, quite large, in the center, operates at about 75, 80 bars, about half the pressure of a pressurized water reactor that we have at Sizewell. Some key parts of this plant, which will emerge as we go through discussing how the accident actually occurred, the refueling bay, quite high up in the plant, quite unusual by our standards. The containment building, the dry well, again, quite unusual. In the case of this particular reactor, you'll notice at the bottom there's a wet well, a torus, and this is required for if you have a loss of turbine and you have to dump the steam when the reactor's been shut down, then the steam is ejected into this water, which eventually condenses it, and then there's emergency core cooling systems which remove the heat in that way. In terms of the accident itself, this is quite a useful illustration, as we've heard. At about 3:15 on the 11th of March, a magnitude 9 earthquake hit the site, took out most of the power grid in northern Japan. And as we've heard, the reactor appears to have remained undamaged. The emergency core cooling system kicked in. But it's interesting to note that when these reactors, even when they're shut down, immediately you've got 6 or 7% of the power from the reactor, which is being generated from the radioactive decay of the fission products in the fuel. So in the case of reactor 1, unit 1, that was about 20, 25 megawatts of heat that had to be removed. And gradually this decays sort of exponentially over time. When the accident happened, everything would occurred as expected. The isolation valves kicked in, the diesel generators came on, emergency core cooling systems were working, and the plant remained safe and in a stable condition as it was designed to do. However, about an hour later, the tsunami hit the plant, as we saw in the picture. The effect of this was to completely take out the diesel generators. It also took out all of the tanks which were containing the oil for the diesel generators, took out all the essential service water buildings and the ability to cool the reactors. Complete station blackout, which is something that we had never contemplated. The only things that were available were the batteries, but these obviously could not do most things. Control rooms were blacked out, no instrumentation. Basically, the operators were faced with a complete failure of the emergency systems, with very little instrumentation to tell them what was happening. Now, at the time, we were very little information was available, and we I think because there was no major airborne release of radioactivity, and we didn't know exactly how long the cooling had been off, I think we were a bit optimistic in thinking that there was still some coolable geometry inside the reactors. But as was reported by TEPCO a few days ago, it would appear that from the information that they have now, that between 4 and 5 hours after the tsunami hit, the water level in reactor one dropped below the level of the fuel rods, and these began to melt, and UO2 melted about 2,800 degrees centigrade. About 14 hours later, that's on the early morning on the 12th of March, it would appear that the operators, seeing very high temperatures, decided to inject water. About an hour after that, it was clear that basically all the fuel rods had melted and the fuel had slumped to the bottom of the pressure vessel. Now, one thing which is different here than what happened at Three Mile Island was that at Three Mile Island, there was still containment. Here, TEPCO are indicating that there are actually some holes in the bottom of the pressure vessel through which the molten fuel is leaking. And that is some considerable difference. The reasons why that's happening, I don't know. It could be that this is the pressure vessel's not as thick as in the case of Three Mile Island. But it may also be associated with the fact that the control rods, the shutdown rods, are from the bottom. And so there'll be a lot of penetrations coming through at the bottom. And it could be that the combination of those penetrations and the lack of thickness of the pressure vessel compared to Three Mile Island has resulted in this development. So what actually happened? We thought that perhaps what was happening, there was the fuel was overheating. It was reacting with the steam. That was building up pressure in the pressure vessel. As a consequence of that, the pressure release valves would open, and as the diagram shows, the steam would be ejected into the wet well where it would be condensed. But because there was no emergency cooling capability in the wet well, the water became saturated, and the volatile, the steam and volatile fission products and hydrogen was escaping into that dry well. Eventually, the pressure in that dry well started to increase. And so to decrease that, the operators vented the dry well, possibly not realizing the extent of the hydrogen that was available. That then leaked into the rest of the building. And in the case of reactor one, as you see in the picture, blew the top off. Now, in this, as I mentioned, the first containment, apart from the reactor pressure vessel, is that big bulb, which is the primary containment. But the concrete structure of the facility is also a secondary containment, but the superstructure on the top is there just for a weathertight to enable the various operations to take place. So no containment capability. The other concern at the time was the spent fuel ponds. And we can see here that there was talk very early on of steam coming out of the spent fuel ponds, indicating that maybe they were boiling dry. At first, I couldn't understand why it was happening so quickly, because even Unit 4, which there is quite a lot of fuel in that storage pond, about 1,400 assemblies, because the reactor is out of operation at the moment, it would have taken perhaps 10 days for that water to boil. And for the other units, it's several weeks. So we couldn't understand why in a matter of a few days water was having to be put into the top of the reactors to try and fill up these fuel ponds. And one of the concerns was that if the water did level did drop and the fuel was exposed, and some of that fuel was relatively fresh because it had been defueled from the reactor for the maintenance activities, then there would be no containment for the release of fission products into the atmosphere. And the assumption was that the explosion that occurred in reactor 4 was as a result of the hydrogen produced by the reaction between the zirconium cladding and the water in the fuel ponds. But again, the latest information coming out of Japan, you know, is that's not the case. And in fact, the explosion that ripped apart Unit 4 actually came from Unit 3, from interconnecting pipework. And so the hydrogen that was being evolved as a result of Unit 3 eventually leaked into Unit 4, and it was that that caused the explosion and structural damage. And that there's no significant damage of the fuel in Unit 4, but we have no information on the state of the fuel storage ponds in the other reactors. And this is one of the latest photographs that has been published. You can see the spent fuel pond in Unit 3 is covered with the debris from the explosion. And we don't know the extent to which that debris itself will have caused damage to the fuel, maybe, of course, some local overheating. But the interesting thing is in the fuel sitting in Unit 4 looks perfectly okay. Doesn't look damaged at all. The only issue that I've got is, why is it still necessary to keep topping up the water in that pond? You know, there must be some damage to the structure which is causing it to leak. So I, you know, when I was sort of looking at all this, what were the key issues that I would sort of focus on? Well, clearly there's, you know, the design for external hazards, obviously, seismic events, tsunamis and flooding, loss of off-site power, all the usual things that we would normally cover in our safety cases. But also this highlighted the robustness of the site infrastructure, especially in relation to the emergency core cooling systems. We take into account loss of off-site power. This is quite a frequent event, but it's the loss of the secondary systems, the emergency backup systems, which is quite challenging. And also one of the things that was quite clear in the early days was that the operators ran out of water. For a short time, they ran out of the ability to pump seawater. So the availability of emergency water supplies is something which I thought we should focus on. Severe accident management is something that developed post Three Mile Island to cover the situation that once you've gone past your design basis, where you're into a situation where your normal safety approaches don't work, how can you then manage the subsequent long-term action? And again, this particular incident has highlighted for me the extent to which emergency operating instructions, the way people behave, the way people are trained to deal with these very low probability but high consequence events. And then finally, I thought, well, the other area that I would want to focus on would be emergency planning, on-site exercises to respond to severe accidents are something that we don't usually do very often. And equally, off-site exercises to test the readiness of the government system and the emergency services, we tend to do quite well, but not in relation to accidents which are resulting from outside the site. So if I just quickly look at standards, where did they come from? Well, in case of seismic, the early nuclear plants in the UK were not designed specifically to with seismic loading in mind, although because they were very robustly engineered, when we look back at them, they had quite significant robustness for responding to emergencies. But all the new plants designed after the late 70s were designed to meet seismic response criteria. And these were set out by in the NII's safety assessment principles, which were emerging in the sort of mid to late 70s and were published in 79. And these were the original 1979 SAPs, which basically was saying that the designers have to consider a safe shutdown earthquake, which we now call a design basis earthquake, and that they should take into account the most severe challenges in relation to local locations and a whole variety of other things in those early SAPs, which really gave the designers a clear guide as to what they had to meet. And in relation to flooding, again, the SAPs identified what the designers had to do in terms of dealing with these very low frequency, high consequence events. In the case of the seismic, the latest AGRs, Torness and Heysham, the size will be class of PWRs, because you remember there were going to be five PWRs built to the same design as Sizewell B, and the designers took the view that they would design them to the most severe seismic loading, so they had the same design wherever they built it. The Thorpe plant at Sellafield was built designed to meet these new standards, and similarly, all the new plants after Thorpe at Sellafield were designed against this 10 to the minus 4 probability of exceedance, which for the UK came out to about 0.25 G, which is 245 gal, and which is a normal standard used for seismic characterization. And the latest Japanese standard is about 1,000, so it's about four times the level that we expected plants in the UK to be designed to. But in the UK, we had an additional criteria, which it wasn't sufficient just to design that your plant could withstand the 0.25 G earthquake, and then the safety-related plants and equipment would behave exactly after the event as before it. We also required the designers to look at a 40% higher event, i.e. 0.35 G, just to make sure that there was no catastrophic failure. You could have failure in superstructure and other things, but there was at the 40% overload, that there was no catastrophic failure that would result in uncontrolled release of radioactivity. And again, flooding was designed against the 1 in 10,000 year flood. Now, in terms of where we are today, the modern standards are set by the International Atomic Energy Agency. These are the sort of global reference point, and they are certainly much more demanding than the initial early IAEA safety standards. The Nuclear Inspectorate reviewed the safety assessment principles in the about 2004, 5 and 6, and those SAPs were aligned against the IAEA standards, so all new facilities in the United Kingdom would be expected to meet the IAEA SAP requirements. And essentially, these new SAPs are not all that different from those original ones set out in 1979. As well as design, there's also the regulatory system, which has an impact on the design for plants for against external hazards. And just briefly, in the United Kingdom, you can't actually design or construct or operate a nuclear facility without a nuclear site license. And the standard license has some 36 conditions attached to it. And within those conditions, there's a whole range of requirements for safety case covering the design, commissioning, construction, operation, and indeed decommissioning. And in addition to that, there are periodic safety reviews, so that every 10 years, the operators have to review their safety requirements against modern standards, and then any plant improvements would be based upon the as low as reasonably practical criterion. So in terms of some of my interim sort of observations, I came to the conclusion that the UK standards for nuclear power plants are robust and they are appropriate. I think the UK licensing regime is comprehensive. It requires the engineering substantiation of design and operations to meet all the external hazards of seismic and wind and flooding. And I think the periodic safety reviews is really essential to ensure that the plants are regularly assessed against changes in standards to ensure that all plants are operating to the highest levels at all times. In terms of the robustness of the site infrastructure, I thought that perhaps one should review the standards of supporting facilities. I think the robustness and diversity of the grid supplies is important, but as I've said, for most plants, loss of off-site power is a fairly frequent event for which systems are designed to cope with. I think it's more important to look at diversity and redundancy of emergency power supplies on the site and on the facilities. And it was interesting looking at the, I thought, to look at the qualification of the emergency generators storage tanks, again, to make sure that they are being assessed against the same seismic standards as the plant. And very importantly, looking at the diversity and redundance of the emergency core cooling water supplies. I think in the UK, as part of our approach to what were originally the long-term safety reviews, followed on by the periodic safety reviews, identified areas where significant improvements were made to our existing plants in this respect. I also thought that perhaps it was an opportunity to look at spent fuel management, looking again at on-site wet storage of spent fuel, whether this is the right thing to do, whether we're doing it correctly. Looking at what's called re-racking policies, and for those of you who don't know what that means is the original ponds were designed to take a certain amount of fuel, and as the demands increased, the designs were not changed, but more fuel was required to be put into the ponds, and there were therefore additional racks to hold the fuel were put in. And there are some issues as to, you know, I think we should perhaps look to make sure that we've still got robust safety cases for those areas where we have re-racked ponds. I think the spent fuels storage cooling systems were clearly an issue, a challenge at Fukushima, and that's one obviously where I think we should look again to make sure that we have robust systems for our cooling ponds. And I think looking generally at our approach to central storage and possibly the implications of dry cask storage would be something that I would look at. I've touched on severe accident management and the ability to make sure that our operators and our operating rules are robust and no doubt will be revised in the light of any lessons learned from Fukushima. I think I've talked about emergency planning, although it would be interesting to look at an emergency plan which resulted from an external event like an earthquake where there is perhaps widespread social disruption. Because we tend to assume in all of our emergency exercises that actually what we're dealing with is problems on the plant, and we can get emergency supplies in, we can get cranes in to lift things, we can get additional supplies of CO2. I think it would be interesting to test out just how robust our systems are in these type of situations. Because I remember once having a discussion with a licensee, which I won't mention the name of, but they were giving me quite a bit of grief for demanding 0.25G seismic qualification for certain plants. And their response was, well, if a 0.25G earthquake hit the United Kingdom, there'd be a lot of houses that would fall down and factories that would fall down. And therefore, why should we worry about having this level of requirement for our nuclear plants? And my response is, well, yes, we'd have a lot of problems, but I wouldn't want them to have a nuclear problem as well. So I think looking at whether our systems are robust in the event where there is widespread societal disruption is important. So three conclusions I would draw. One, yes, Fukushima is an extremely serious event. So far, about one-tenth of the radioactive release of Chernobyl has been seen. Most of that has been into the sea rather than into the air, as in the case of Chernobyl. Given the situation that we know that now that in reactor one and also probably in reactors two and three, the core is slumped and the fuel is sitting on the bottom of the reactor pressure vessel, and at least in one of those there's been a burn through and a leakage. I say it's probably, and given that we also don't know what the current situations are in all of the spent fuel ponds, it's probably too soon to say that the event is safely under control. It'll still take some time to ensure that's the case. I think the UK licensing and standards for nuclear power plants are robust. As I said, I didn't expect the Chief Inspector's review to identify any major deficiencies, which I was sticking my neck out, but I think his report clearly identifies some major recommendations, but no major deficiencies in our system. And I think I would just finally remind people that light water reactors have very high power densities, much higher densities than we have in our gas-cooled reactors. And therefore, any failure of the emergency core cooling, even for a relatively short space of time, really must be shown to be extremely remote. Thank you very much.